I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude is what we do. This one is offstage with the actress and documentarian Anna Deavere Smith of the celebrated one-woman shows that open up, most famously, the hearts and minds caught up in New York and Los Angeles race riots. Her new show, called Let Me Down Easy, is all over the place. Johannesburg, New Orleans after Katrina, Louisville after a heartbreaking Kentucky Derby, and then a Houston hotel room where the brassy ex-governor of Texas, Ann Richards, is dying. There's a range here, at a dicey turn in war, politics, and finance, that makes you wonder what we're all going through. We met Anna Deavere Smith in a dressing room at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She was barefoot, as she always is on stage, the better to walk in the words of the people she's impersonating. We sometimes say the only serious questions that grown-ups ask each other is, what are you going through? What am I going through? And especially in this season with Wall Street melting, everybody's wondering, what are we going through? You're our authority, Anna, but just off the top, what are we going through?
I don't know. I think a transition, and I don't know where we're headed. And I think that there's a huge opportunity for leadership, but it's also daunting. I'm sure you and I have talked about this before. When I did a project about presidents, it was clear to me that the world is a stage that a president gets to sort of strut on, given whatever the circumstances are. So, you know, Roosevelt had a huge stage to walk on, and this is what's going to be necessary now. So it's both an opportunity and an enormous challenge for whoever comes in and takes that role. I just don't know what's going on or how long it's going to last. You just don't know. Is this something that's going to be over quickly and we're all hysterical sort of getting... I saw on television this morning that people are buying safes, you know, or people sort of turning their money into rubies and, you know, sewing it into the inside of their coats.
They have no mattresses?
I just don't know. Probably the sale of mattresses has gone up. So,
but also people are puzzled about what it is. Is it a financial crisis? Is it a spiritual crisis? Is it a military crisis? Is it a historic, like, end of the USA as we've known it in the world crisis?
Well, I have no way of knowing if it's the end of the USA as we know it in the world. And, you know, I think part of it is about the amount of information we get, the diversity of information that we get, and how many times wolf has cried. So I don't even think that... we have enough information to know what it is that's going on. I don't have enough information to know what this is.
So here's your show, Let Me Down Easy, in which you ask the question in so many settings. What's going on in church? What's going on in Rwanda? What's going on in New Orleans? What's going on at Harvard? What's going on in medical care? What's going on when Ann Richards is facing death? You're everywhere, and nobody listens and reproduces quite as vividly as you do. What are you saying about each of these places? What are they going through?
Well, I am looking at all those places through the lens of, is there any grace here? Is there any grace in a tough situation? And then, and doing that search, also trying to define grace at the same time. And finding people who are the exemplars of grace, even in the places that you would least expect to find it. For example, in Rwanda, who would think that you could go to Rwanda, the site of a genocide, and find grace? And I did, in the form of the way that people are dealing with the idea of forgiveness. And one of the characters talks about giving grace and actually differentiating that from giving forgiveness, because she says that forgiveness is something that you give when someone asks for it. And her, you know, sort of awful predicament is that the killers of her family haven't come to ask for forgiveness. So she's been holding this forgiveness ready for them, and they're not coming. So then what do? You can't even do the act that the country has asked you to do. And so she says, well, so I'm giving them grace. And I'm saying, I'm not holding on to you in my heart anymore. And when you think of that, that's a very strong move to free yourself from the entanglement of the back and forth mm-hmm. that what it could be to be with an oppressor of any kind, a killer of any kind, mm-hmm. Suffering, to end the suffering.
Mm-hmm. Grace is the subtext of this show, Grace in the Dark. Take another example of grace as you find it in this performance.
Well, I think that this woman that I met in New Orleans right after Katrina, Dr. Kirsten Kurtz-Burke, who is working in a poverty hospital, a public hospital, charity hospital. I'm told that Bellevue and Charity compete with each other about which one was the first hospital for poor people in America. And, you know, she talks about being there in this poor hospital during the storm and, you know, her patients realizing before she did that nobody was going to come and get them. Mm-hmm. And already she's a doctor who believes that there's no reason why you can't give people, regardless of their economic status, you should be able to give them the best possible care in the world. Mm-hmm. But she wasn't able to do that. She realized it was bigger than she was.
Can I ask you to drop into character here?
Let's see. Well, I'll drop in the end, a little bit end of it, where she says, that must be what it would be like your whole life to know, you know, we just have to do for ourselves because they're not going to come and get us. That complete abandonment, that was new for me. Being abandoned, that was all new for me. But for my patients and the people who work at Charity Hospital, it's just one more thing. And they just went about their business. Every nurse worked nonstop for 6 days in that heat with no power, with a flashlight. They never missed a vital sign. They never missed a urine output. They never missed a trick. And with this heavy sense of resignation. And so that whole thing that I had always tried to, that whole facade that, you know, you're here at Charity Hospital, but don't worry about it. We're going to give you the best possible care. We are going to give you the best possible care, but we can't make FEMA and the government come and get us.
Mm. That's one of the magic moments in that whole show, I think. Magic people. One more example. You don't have to act it, but of places where you found grace. And then I want to push you a little bit on it.
Well, I went, you know, first of all, I expected to find it in religion. So I talked to four clergy. Sounds like a joke. Five clergy. Peter Gomes, who's, you know, well-known here at Harvard. James Cone, who is a Union Theological Seminary, a black liberation theologist. People who followed what went on with Reverend Wright are not strangers to that term anymore. He's probably one of the foremost black liberation scholars, a Buddhist monk who I found in the entourage of the Dalai Lama this summer, Rabbi David Wolpe in Los Angeles, and an Imam Abdul Faisal Rauf, who is an imam in New York. And what I found out was that in terms of religion, it's really a Christian idea.
Amen.
There's no word for it in Hebrew. The Buddhists don't think that way. They think about original goodness rather than original sin. And the imam, you know, sort of understood where it was coming from and translated a word as grace, but that's not really at the center of what they're talking about either. Whereas, you know, the Christian idea of grace is that, to quote Peter Gomes, we all have a share in the fallen nature of the human enterprise. And so that, you know, we require some self-criticism and awareness that what we want to do very well may not be the best thing to do. So to open yourself up to be a kind of a soldier of what God would like you to do.
This is the part I have to say that left me hungering for something more. I mean, it is a Christian idea. I don't think you can talk about or think about grace without St. Paul. And, you know, the many, many lines about grace, but maybe most famously, where sin abounded, grace abounds, that something new in the world came with Jesus Christ. I always think also of the last line of the Bernanos novel, The Diary of a Country Priest, and he's tormented by all sorts of temptations and realities of rural poor France, but his dying words are the discovery that grace is everywhere. But particularly the notion of grace as a catalyst, rather unlike what Peter said, it's a catalyst of a completely different vision of reality, of ourselves, of power, of the truth of the world, and it is transformative. It's not remotely a secular blessing, although it's funny, we all remember, it's funny how after the show, everybody remembered the grace that they grew up with at the table. You too, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember yours?
God is great, God is good. Something like thanking him for the food.
We used to say, on my mother's instruction, we would say, and we still say, we thank the Lord for happy hearts, for rain and sunny weather. We thank the Lord for this, our food, and that we are together.
That's very good.
And usually with my kids, I say, you know, even if some of us are more together than others. But it's a kind of, anyway, not to be confused, though, I think with this kind of miracle of consciousness that comes with, who knows what, the Holy Spirit or God or, but it's, I think it's a Christian miracle, and people were wary of, and I think even the play is wary of dealing with that piece of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, because I think that the definition of grace is broader than the religious definition of it. Mm-hmm. You know, that we find it in the world, in the garden. You know, I visit a garden to find it. You know, we find it in other kinds of kindnesses. In a way, I'm thinking about it almost like kindness. So the other exemplar to me of grace, and I don't know what her religious background is at all, is a woman in Johannesburg, South Africa, who has an orphanage for children who are dying of AIDS, and she sits with every child who's dying and talks to them about what's happening to her. I think she's the exemplar of grace for the whole show. So I'm looking at it as broader than the religious idea. If you look it up in the OED, it goes on and on and on and on and on. The word.
Yeah.
And even remember, you know, sort of your grace, speaking of a king as your grace. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you want to give us that AIDS nurse, that AIDS woman?
It's pretty long. We had four or five children, babies, who passed away. And this year we've had one so far. And what happens is they find me any time of the night and say, this little kid is very, very sick. And I'll sit with the child until the child passes away. So I make sure that I'm there for every child. Well, they don't know death. That's how I see it. They don't know that they're dying. They just know that they're very sick type of thing. But the older children that we've got here, the 12-year-old and the 14-year-old that we've got here, I sit and I talk to them the whole time about death. And we had one child here, Nomza, Charlene Hunter-Gold of CNN, knew Nomza very, very well. And I sat with our Nomza for days and hours and telling about the virus, telling about death. And Nomza knew that she was not going to make the weekend. And so Nomza came to see me on the Friday afternoon, and she said that her mother had passed away. Nomza came to see me on the Friday afternoon, and she said that her mother had visited her the night before. Now, I knew that her mother had passed away 6 years prior to that. So I sat her down, and I said, well, what time did your mother visit you? She said, no, it was late at night. I said, well, if you see your mother tonight again, if your mother visits you tonight again, you must tell her that I said thank you very, very much, that I could look after you for so long. And she said, no, she will. And that morning, the Saturday morning, I came in here, and Nomza was sitting on the stair. And she said that her mother had visited her the night again. And she said that her mother said that she must pack all her clothes, that she's coming to fetch her. She's going home. And I promise you it was. And I walked up to her. I said, did you tell your mother that I said thank you very much? And she said, yes. And my mom says, thank you very much. I had gone into her room. All her clothes were packed, put in plastic bags, and it was waiting for her. That Sunday morning at 3:00 in the morning, Nomza passed away.
So her mummy came and fetched her, and she was prepared. She was prepared to go. She knew she was going to die, and it's not a bad thing. All her clothes were packed. All her teddy bears were packed. I took everything, her clothes, her teddy bears. I put it in her coffin, and she went very happily. I'll just tell them that there are different stages of life. I say you get born, and sometimes when you're born, you're sick. And sometimes you've got this germ, and we talk about the germ. We play. I sit on the carpet and I play with the dolls. I play. I say, look at this ugly germ that's got into the body, and it's making this little child very sick. And sometimes this child has had enough, and then I'll start talking about death. And you know they're getting sicker, and you know they're going to the next stage. And they ask questions like, what happens if I'm dead? I say, nobody can answer that. And they ask about God. And they ask, can we come back and visit you when we're dead? You know, that type of thing. They always just want to say, can we come back to Chance Orphanage when we're dead? You know, that type of thing. And I just tell them, you're always in my heart. Even if you've passed away, you're always in my heart. You're always with me, you know. So, in any case, don't leave them in the dark. Don't leave them in the dark. And that's Trudy Howell from Johannesburg, South Africa, who started and runs the Chance Orphanage. They're the only orphanage only for children whose parents died of AIDS, and the children themselves are dying.
Anna DeVere Smith, that's Grace in the Dark, and so powerful, and thank you. Thank you for thinking it. Thank you for recording it. Thank you for doing it for us. Maybe that resolves the Grace question. I don't know. What do you think?
I hope so.
I think the country, in some strange way, is groping for Grace, don't you? Is that too much in a Wall Street crisis?
I just think that I haven't really thought about that idea of you know, I haven't really, this isn't a play, whereas my other better known plays are, you could easily say they're a critique of some aspect of American society. Hmm. I don't see this play as a critique of the culture. I see it as really a journey, and maybe it's one reason I went elsewhere in the world, a journey to find something nice about the fact that we're mortal, you know, and what do we do about that? But I have to say, if I had written a play that was a critique of this culture and its lack of grace, I think it's really lacking right now. I just, you know, I love New York City, that's where I live, but I see so much wealth on a daily basis, and I don't feel good about the way it's displayed at all, at all, at all, at all. To quote Johnny Apple, that's what his piece was called, and in my play it's called At All, At All, At All, At All. But and even as a teacher, you know, I've been teaching for so long now, and, you know, the cost of education is outrageous, and the way that students come to school, therefore, as consumers, is that's without grace. And the fact of what they have to, how they're going to have to live their lives to pay for that is without grace. The disparity between rich and poor is a lack of grace. How culture has become so much of a great big game show in every aspect is a lack of grace. I see a lack of grace in, I have different professions, the way that we treat one another is a lack of grace. So, you know, I see the lack. And I think I went to a different level. Probably we could call it, I don't know if it's a more spiritual level, but I wanted to make something that felt more like a smaller than a critique and less harsh than a critique, because I wanted the audience to feel good. I wanted them to feel the beauty in the human condition. Mm-hmm. And so my choices of who's in the play, the choices of the music, Schubert's Quintet is at the center of it, and Joshua Redman has written some beautiful jazz, which is a response to the quintet. I wanted people to experience beauty. Mm-hmm. And so I moved away from the critique. It is implied. The medical care system, that certainly is critiqued. There's an implied critique, but I don't think it's a direct critique.
Speaking of dealing with mortality, I mean, the piece in the play that everybody talks about is the irrepressible Ann Richards discovering her chi in the last days and talking about it brilliantly. I mean, can you summon up the late great governor of Texas?
Well, the late great governor of Texas is someone who I got to know in probably the last decade of her life, and spent quite a bit of time with her. I was able to go on a river rafting trip with she and her Texas friends, and I, you know, was in Houston when she was being treated for esophageal cancer with a very, very new kind of therapy, a brand new center. I visited the center, the Proton Therapy Center, as a part of MD Anderson Cancer Center. And, you know, and I'd interviewed Anne before. She appears in two of my other works. She's, or one of them, but I do two different Anne Richards plus this one. You know, her attitude about life, as one of her friends said, was, you know, take the hill. Take the hill. And I never knew her to be, you know, if I ever felt like I was complaining around her, I felt sort of silly doing it, you know, because I knew that she wouldn't have much time for that. She's not a whiner. She just goes for it. And she's had a way with words. So I think this material, the chi piece in the play, kind of works everywhere I do it. You know, she's very special.
I want to hear it again.
Sure. Well, let's talk about something else, Anna. And this comes at the moment of the play where we start to talk about death, so it's sort of great that, you know, I've sort of brought her in. Let's talk about something else, Anna, that I think is really important to say to you. I have two choices every day. When I get up, I can feel good or I can feel bad. And a whole lot of what I feel is in my brain. So if I get up in the morning and say, and I know to live one day at a time by now. So if I get up in the morning and say, this is going to be a great day, then it's a better day. But if I am not going to buy into a sickness life. So when I get up in the morning, I say to myself, this is going to be a great day. And even when it isn't, it's better. Because I am conscious that what I think has a whole lot to do with how I feel. Want some bread? Huh? No, I was not the first woman governor of Texas. In the 20s, there was Pa Ferguson, who was governor. And Pa was married to Ma. Now, Pa died, and Ma became governor. Now, she was the one, when asked about bilingual education, who said, if the English language is good enough for Jesus Christ, it's good enough for everybody. Dr. Cox told me I'm the first person in the world to have this combination of proton therapy and chemotherapy at the same time. My daughter, Ellen, has managed this whole thing for me, so I don't have to use up my chi doing that. Well, that's what it is. That's your light. That's your life force. And you have to save that to beat this physical thing that you have. I go to this woman, and she does what's called energy work with me. Isn't it wonderful? And I remember telling her that I'd had a hell of a day. A guy came up, he just had to see me that day. No, just a friend, but he needed some advice, and he couldn't wait. And then, too, there's something about being indomitable. Anyway, he was there. Then he left. Then another guy came, and he was there. Then I had to go all the hell the way to the north of town to do something, and by the time I got to her, I was really whipped. So she said, "Anne, you are using up your chi. You're giving it to all these other people, and you can't do that now. You have to save your chi. That's your mantra from now on." And this, Chris, this is an exception, but it's just second nature of me to give all I've got, but I just can't do it. I've been good. People call me up. I say, "I can't talk to you right now. You're using up my chi." They put me on a regimen. I can't shake hands. I can't hug people. I can't do all the things I did to be governor. It's just I can't do it. I just say to people, "I'm so sorry I can't shake your hand. I'm on chemotherapy." People get too close to step back. I would love for you to meet my oncologist. I get so tickled. Her name is Dr. Phan. She's Vietnamese. I said, "Well, Dr. Phan, do you have children?" She said, "No, I'm married to this hospital. You're my girl." What could be better than that? And when you see her too, you're going to know she's married to the hospital. I think they kind of handpicked the doctors who work best for the patients they assigned her to me. You know what? I don't think I have any Republicans on my team.
She took the hill again. Anna DeVere Smith, I can't thank you enough.
Thank you.
You are such a gift to this country and to us, really and truly. That's on the record.
Thank you for having me on the show. Great to be back.
Great pleasure.
With you, Chris.
Anna DeVere Smith, thank you. Sarah Archambault produced and edited this conversation. Please add your two bits or take it in your own direction with a comment at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining us.